This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. There are many ways to make social change. Street activism and protests, political organizing, running for office, petitioning, boycotts, and more. Today, we'll turn to the author of a new book who has highlighted how principled lawyers are using the legal system as a tool for social change. Maria Armudian is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. She's the author of Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, and Reporting from the Danger Zone. She now joins me to discuss her latest book called Lawyers Without Borders, Advancing International Rights Through Local Laws and Courts. Welcome to the program, Maria.
It is great to be with you, Sonali. It's been too long.
It has, absolutely. So let's talk about this latest book that you've written, which has such a sweeping international view of justice, of the courts. I imagine that this was a complicated book to write because any legal system is complicated of any single jurisdiction. You're not just covering a single country, you're covering many, many different countries, many jurisdictions here.
Mostly it focuses on the United States and on this group of lawyers who were civil rights lawyers that were trying to get justice for survivors of torture and genocide and massacres through the United States courts, and how they built a movement here in the United States to do that, despite all the laws that normally would make this thing difficult, but how they creatively found ways to get them into the US courts. And the long arc of it is that then, yes, they did have to go abroad. But really the focus was on how these ideas, how creative they were. Because what happens, I think, with all of us who have an international focus is we see all these horrific violations of human rights, and we feel so helpless and so despaired about not being able to do anything. And yet these lawyers were like, well, we've got these tools, and we know that they've worked in these other scenarios. Let's just try this and see if we can creatively get it through the courts. And they started this movement. Now, sadly, the movement has been truncated. But let me just, unless you have another question, I could just
start. No, go for it.
So I think the main starting point is that back at this period of time, which was the late 70s, you had two movements that were really alive. One was the civil rights movement in the United States, and the other was the international human rights movement. So at this point in time, you know, groups like Amnesty International had sway. And in the United States, you know, groups like the NAACP and the ACLU and a lot of these various legal groups were advancing rights for people. One group would get some rights. So, for example, by the end of the 1950s, after they had gotten segregation declared illegal and they started to get redress for African Americans, your lawyers started to move this to other groups who had also been aggrieved, women, the accused, LGBT later on. And to various extents, they were winning redress rights. People were getting restitution for their rights being violated. And this was largely done in the courts. And then the other branches were sort of complementing them. You know, back when Brown versus Board of Education happened in the 1950s, the Kennedy administration then kicked in and started to help with all of their administrative activities, and Congress passed laws. So it was a sort of interbranch thing with civil society moving, not exactly in tandem, but one following the other. What happened is there was a couple of lawyers who worked at CCR as volunteers.
This is the Center for Constitutional Rights.
That's right. And one of them is a guy named Peter Weiss, who's in his 90s now, and I had the great pleasure of getting to interview him for this book. But he was in both movements. He was involved in the civil rights movement. He was involved in the human rights movement. He was a child during the Holocaust, and himself was a refugee coming to the United States. So he deeply in his bones felt what these violations of rights meant on the international scale and the horrors of them. At the same time, he had been schooled in all these, you know, classic ideas about morality and justice. And one of the ideas that had come through the international human rights movement was this idea of universal jurisdiction. And that meant that some crimes are so heinous that they should be prosecuted everywhere, anywhere, any court of law should be able to take them. And he thought, well, torture is among them. Genocide is among them. And so his idea was, all right, the civil rights movement is alive. They have expanded the law for all these groups of aggrieved people. Why can't we expand that for people who have been tortured or have survived genocides or massacres? And so he met, this was in the 70s again, a Paraguayan doctor whose son had been tortured to death in Paraguay by a military man, a Paraguayan military man. And he thought, well, let's test this case. And he found an obscure statute called the Alien Tort Statute that was passed in the first Congress. And it just simply said that aliens had access to the U.S. courts, federal courts had jurisdiction.
And by aliens, of course, we mean resident, rather we mean non-U.S. citizens or people who are not
foreigner,
residents who are foreign. Or citizens of the United States.
Foreigner. That's right. But they used the word alien in the statute. Alien Tort Claims Act was what it was originally called. And it was in the first Judiciary Act. And essentially it just said, if a tort, a civil wrong, violated the laws of nations, then the courts had jurisdiction, federal courts. And he thought, well, that sounds like universal jurisdiction to me. And so he tried this case and he won. The guy happened to be in the United States. They served him. They sued him. They got a $10 million judgment, weren't able to collect. But, you know, just the moral victory was a big deal for the family. So that kept getting expanded. Okay.
So it sounds as though the victims and the accused in many of these cases that you profile are not Americans. This is a way to get international justice for things like torture, horrific crimes, but in the US court system, in as much as the US has any jurisdiction over this.
Right. So the conservative courts have started whittling this down, as you might guess, but it hasn't completely been able to eliminate it. And that's because Congress at the time was inspired by Peter Weiss and the cases that case and then the cases that followed. And they passed something called the Torture Victim Protection Act, which expanded that also for Americans who were violated abroad in similar egregious ways. So there's actually a dedicated statute, which was intended to not just, serve for the victims, but to endorse what the original statute did and expand it. So it's been impossible for the courts to completely eliminate it, but they have truncated it as much as they could possibly truncate by, you know, in ways that you don't expect. If you're a true student of the Supreme Court, a purist, shall we say, you wouldn't expect them to do this to a Congress, but they've gotten a lot of power and they've been able to do this.
Now, of course, the United States itself is often a perpetrator of horrific torture. We can think of Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo. Have these same laws been used to hold American perpetrators accountable for victims against non-Americans? They tried.
Yeah, they tried. They tried using both the Alien Tort Statute. They tried using the Torture Victim Protection Act. And the courts essentially said they dismissed the cases against the high-level officials in the United States based on things like national security and based on ideas such as state secrets. But there were a couple of cases that did settle. And that was because bad as it is that the United States has turned to using increasingly these private contractors for military, that has opened up an avenue to get some redress for some of the victims. So there were a couple of cases in which, three that I can think of off the top of my head, in which the survivors of these awful violations have gotten some form of redress. One was against Blackwater. One was against the private contractors who were involved in Abu Ghraib torture. And it wasn't all of them. It was one group of them who managed to sue in the state of Maryland. And the other was, there were two psychologists who had designed the CIA's torture program. And there were two survivors and the family of one who died under those horrific conditions. And they managed to get redress from those two psychologists who designed that enhanced interrogation program, which we all know is really just a euphemism.
So when we look at the international arena, there was a time when there was optimism about international crimes being prosecuted. The United Nations is one avenue, but then there's the International Criminal Court, which I know that the U.S. has sort of stymied both these international bodies. How does the ICC play into this? Because the ICC is in the process, in some cases, of pursuing justice for victims of torture.
Yeah, so each of these bodies, and there's more than just the ICC, there's the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights. There are all kinds of courts that get set up as ad hoc tribunals. So there are multiple places where survivors can go and try to get justice and try to hold perpetrators accountable. Now, I had focused primarily on the civil litigation aspect, in part because this was a way that the survivors became plaintiffs, so they were no longer victims per se, that they sued their perpetrator, and that they faced them off in court in this way. But a lot of them are also engaging multiple institutions at one time. A lot of these are political. They all have their own sets of laws and rules are too complicated to kind of get into here. But in some situations where they weren't able to get any kind of redress from US courts, there were some, for example, from the 9/11 war on terror that you mentioned, that did go to the Inter-American Court. And there's in one case, a man who was renditioned, who was Canadian, an engineer, just a very nice guy, and tortured in Syria, he got his redress out of Canada, $10 million. He put it towards helping other torture victims.
Wow.
But the United States never did redress him. So it is complicated, but I think the point of the book is, first of all, these are ideas that are timeless. And it's sort of a creative amalgamation of time and statutes and persuasion and advocacy in a really difficult situation. So it takes a lot of grit, sheer grit to pursue these. There's not a lot of money in this for the lawyers.
I was just going to ask you, it sounds like it takes a lot of resources, and often, as you point out in your book, the accused are big corporations, or can be big corporations, such as Royal Dutch Shell.
That's the hardest. This is the hardest because the ICC doesn't take on corporations at this point, or hasn't. And the U.S. Supreme Court has essentially protected corporations from the Alien Tort Statute. They've used an idea called extraterritoriality, saying that the violation has to touch and concern the United States, which wasn't in the original statute. But they have managed to whittle it down in that way. And that was first decided in a case brought by an Ogoni, an indigenous Ogoni woman of Nigeria, against Royal Dutch Petroleum, which had, been working with Nigeria. Her husband was hung to death. There were eight others in addition to him. And the community was just terrorized from all of the human rights violations that had occurred there as a result of this oil exploration and all of the other awful things that were happening. But the court decided in her case of this idea of extraterritoriality, it had to touch and concern the United States. They just affirmed that in a case brought by children who were essentially slaves against, they had sued Nestle because they had been forced into labor. They
to as make children, chocolate. So child labor. Yeah.
And the court again said it has to touch and concern the United States. And just because they made decisions in the United States doesn't necessarily make it strong enough for the kids to bring the lawsuit. So these are decisions made by the Supreme Court, which I would argue go against what the Congress has wanted. So against, legislative intent. So it is a court moving in a direction that maybe was not originally the plan.
Maria, let's talk about the lawyers themselves, because none of this would be possible without, as you pointed out earlier, the grit, the determination of individuals pursuing these, labyrinthine avenues for justice. And, there's many different ways to pursue justice. There's boycotts and petitions and street protests. This is one of many, many different ways, but it's a, I imagine, a sort of backbreakingly difficult way, but can have some very tangible success. And imagine it takes some sheer dedication on the part of individuals. Tell me about some of these lawyers. You mentioned one earlier from CCR, but there's quite a few people, a small army of lawyers that takes on such cases. Right?
Yeah, I was really inspired by them. Look, the whole thing, this whole book sort of dawned on me while I was doing a radio program at Pacifica. And there was a case, I interviewed the lawyer for a particular case. You've had him on your program, Dan Stormer.
Mm, yeah.
And Dan had sued the oil company Unocal on behalf of these indigenous Burmese people who had been also tortured, enslaved, killed. To build a pipeline in Burma at the time. And they actually settled out of court for about $30 million. And that money has gone on to support all kinds of programs in Burma for the community. The cases often take decades. So the lawyers have to have ways to support themselves. A lot of times they double as something else. In Dan's case, he's a civil rights lawyer. So he takes on all these other cases that do have some money coming in so that he can take a case that is going to take forever and then may or may not come to fruition and may cost him. He was involved along with CCR and Earth Rights, which is one of the most important organizations, Earth Rights International, which started this movement to bring the corporations to some accountability in these cases. A lot of them are nonprofits. A lot of them double as something else. Some of them are law professors. Paul Hoffman, who is in Los Angeles, teaches at UCI, teaches international law and constitutional law. He used to be at the ACLU. Again, he has to double as something else in order to be able to do these cases. So it's really kind of overtime work, but it's obviously people using the tools that they have to make a difference and thinking, I hate to use the phrase outside of the box, but thinking creatively, thinking innovatively, and being a little bit audacious about what you might be able to do in times that look so dark.
And we know it takes creativity to use existing laws to one's benefit. The conservative movement is very good at using it to their benefit. And we know that progressive lawyers, in the interest of upholding human rights, have also done a remarkable job.
I think that's one of the points, too, is how these civil rights movements that have come up through, 1950s to today, that have expanded rights for so long, have been hijacked in many ways now by the, I don't even like to call them conservative, but by the selfish crew, that want more for themselves and less for everybody else. And sadly, they've gained rights for corporations and gained rights for, the wealthy, in part by limiting access to the courts.
Maria, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with your book. Can't wait to see what you work on next.
Thanks so much, Sonali. Great being with you. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Maria Armudian, senior lecturer at the University of Auckland, author of numerous books, including Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, and Reporting from the Danger Zone. We've been discussing her latest book, Lawyers Without Borders, Advancing International Rights Through Local Laws and Courts. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.